From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of our humble podcast. As you'll have worked out by now, our master of ceremonies, Mr. Williams, 009, is not with us today. Who knows where he is, but we do have Captain Morgan. How are you, Giles?
I'm very well, Roger. I'm very well indeed. Thank you.
You're going to help me with this today without Grant, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to be your muscle man, mate. I'm going to be your muscle man. We'll walk the plank together, to use a pirate metaphor again.
By the way, that's just superb, these people you're getting on. It's just amazing, the guest list. Good for you.
Well, I'm very excited. As you know, Rory McIlroy is next up, and we're getting a lot of people asking about that. So I think with this whole Are You Not Entertained series we've got, it's we're cracking this, I think, slowly.
Definitely. Listen, Giles, before we've got the guest to introduce, and I'm going to let you do that, I wanted to ask you a little bit. This was clearly more of a rugby weekend than anything else in sport. How did you live what we saw at the weekend, and how do you feel about some of the things that happened around the Calcutta Cup?
Well, it's an odd one. I feel neutral in as far as I support Wales, as you know.
But of course.
In a former life, I was very lucky. I ran the sponsorship for the famous Grouse Whiskey and spent 6 years of my life up in Edinburgh handing out whiskey to anyone who cared to drink it, which was many. So I got to know the Scotland setup very well. And the Calcutta Cup was obviously one of the most exciting weekends of the year, be it home or away. And the whole joy of rugby union has always been is that you have these fantastically sort of ballistic confrontations of big men running into each other. And then afterwards, everyone going off for a beer. And I must say, and I don't know if it was Eddie Jones fueling it. I don't know if it was the media just being hypersensitive. But a storm in a teacup, as well as a storm clearly on the pitch, kind of evolved. And it was all very unedifying because it's absolutely not what, you know, of course, what happens on the pitch. It's hard, hard, bloody warfare. And that's how it should be. But afterwards, it's a game and everyone moves on. And I was quite disappointed. But once again, Roger, I felt, and I'm not really being naive here, it felt like the media were kind of stirring this one up to create a story. Eddie Jones is definitely polemic. He's definitely someone who takes a bite. But that's all he's doing. And that's not new. Brian Clough did it a lot. You know, people have been doing that forever. I just think it's how things are taken. But it comes back to being in a slightly snowflakey generation where everybody takes offence at everything all the time.
Well, that's true. And normally I would agree with that, but I did love the letter, I think it was to the Times, from the ex-Scotland captain, Peter Brown, who I remember well. That was the years, as you know, Giles, that I really enjoyed my rugby in that era. And I remember him very, very well. That strange physique he had and everything. It was always somebody that resonated with me. He was saying that that's not what the game's about at all. And I just feel the whole thing with also the turmoil in the Scotland camp between the coach and the fly half, it just didn't feel right this weekend.
No, it didn't. And I do know what you mean. And I think with the weather as well, it was an absolutely diabolical game. And I think both sides had a real problem either sort of catching the ball because of the bad weather or kicking it anywhere sensibly. So it was a shame. It has been such a wonderful encounter. And for Scotland in the past, who when they've snatched victory and it's all been, you know, very much about national pride and et cetera, it didn't quite feel like it lived up to previous billings. I agree with that.
Yeah. Changing tack a little bit, and it's something I wanted to ask you when we were discussing Grant and I sponsorship the other episode. There's so much changing in this area now. You know, you've got people complaining about betting companies. You've got sponsors around the cup competitions in football that must be very perturbed by the way that they've been downplayed by some of the big clubs. you've got this whole move to data-driven as opposed to media values. And you're somebody that obviously has lived this for most of their career on one side of the fence or the other. How would you deal with what's happening now and how it's evolving? How would you be allocating your portfolio thinking for 2020 and beyond?
It's a really interesting question, Roger. And when I sort of take myself back to my old role of working in sponsorship, clearly the business proposition, the value proposition that sponsorship used to be was based on television audiences. And that kind of gave you an approximation of media value. And then you'd throw in things like hospitality and other things that might be of value to a sponsor. And it was a relatively simple, if very inexact equation, thrown in with a whole lot of emotion, often from senior management from a company about the sort of things they felt they should sponsor. As a result of that, sponsorship has always been a little bit of a poor cousin to advertising. And I always think being a bit of a, it was always the first to go in downturns because you could never really put your finger on what the return on investment is. With data, with knowledge, not of an eyeball, but actually of real people, which is fans and the data that they, the trail they leave, actually sponsorship should be going into a golden age, in my view. All brands and big corporations are trying to associate and engage with real people, customers. And what data does is allow you to do that. So unfortunately, and it's something you and I have talked about on this podcast and away from the microphone, a lot of the sports industry is still desperately trying to sort of force fit an old business model when a brand new one is there waiting, which is talk to the fan in the fan language and you will get investment from corporate sponsorship. But unfortunately, turning the ship around, or at least in a new direction, is taking a long time. And as you've pointed out often, there isn't that much time because with television money all over the place, and many sports are going to be suffering because of the whole change in channels and media. You could well find that some sports go to the wall, or certainly clubs or leagues, before the tide has turned, I think.
Yeah, and of course, once that whole equation changes, and you're looking for sponsors to have what they call an engaged conversation with those fans that you can know everything about, then it turns very quickly to the world of what content you're serving them to have that engagement. And I think that's a great segue, Giles, to introduce our guest today, which I know you're the best person to do that. So why don't you tell us who's coming on now?
Well, absolutely. And it is very apposite as we talk about the world of content and of television in old money. Our guest this week has been, I think, one of the most influential figures in the international sports industry for quite a long time. But she'd never tell you that. No. Her production company, New Moon, back in the day, created some of the most effective sports content that not only came to our screens in beautiful content form to the public, but maybe more importantly and certainly more influentially, helped countries and cities secure rights to the Olympics, World Cups, World Championships. And Caroline Rowland was founder of New Moon and created a company that was used by nearly all of the rights holders looking for that difference, which particularly for the first 15 years of the 21st century, you didn't not use New Moon if you wanted to win a bid. So that's who she is. And since then, when she's not riding horses or flying planes, skiing, and I think maybe even auditioning for the first ever female 007, she's now founder of a new tech business called Egoli that I think has a good chance of transforming how fans can access personal content. So after having said all of that, Caroline, a very warm welcome to Are You Not Entertained?
Well, hello. Hello, boys. It's very nice to be here.
Hi, Caroline.
Hi, Roger. I'm glad to be doing my bit for addressing the gender balance a bit on the show.
Yeah, we've been woeful on that. We have been absolutely.
That's not
woeful.
Our fault. And
no,
a lot of people have said
it's Grant's fault. It's Grant's fault.
Yeah, it is actually. Everything's his fault today. Everything. Absolutely.
So, Caroline, I referenced at the top of the show that you've done an awful lot of things in your career, bringing extraordinary films both to the public and also to bids in every sport virtually. It felt like New Moon, you couldn't win a bid without using you, but you're not doing that anymore. And I know you sort of jump out of planes and do all sorts of clever things, but since you've stopped making us all cry with the power of sport, what are you up to now?
Well, first of all, I never had any intention of making anybody cry. I think really, you know, all good things come to an end. And there was an absolute glorious period in Olympic bidding and in sports bidding where narrative lay at the very soul of what bids were all about. And, you know, the world moved on. So I sold New Moon in 2017 and had a look at the content universe. And I suppose, much like many other people in the space, pivoted towards doing something that was oriented towards the mass market and the requirement of many more people than those very, very niche, very, very specific lobbying or bidding films. So I've started I'm a Hollywood, well, I'm a West Coast cliche now. I live in Los Angeles and run a tech startup called Egoli Media.
Fantastic.
And we have, it's very good fun. I have to say, there's a lot to be said for West Coast life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Egoli Media is basically a technology that allows content owners to personalize their content and deliver it directly to consumers as the consumer wants, as opposed to how a broadcaster wants to deliver it. So that's what I'm up to.
Well, it sounds amazing. And before we sort of talk more about tech and stuff, which Roger's brilliant at, because he's really clever. He's a clever one here. Just given that you know the political landscape of sport as well as you do, what happened? It felt that at one point every city and country in the world was bidding for absolutely everything. And then over a period of time, it seemed to stop. And now it seems that no one really bids for anything. There seem to be sort of slam dunk deals that are done between whether it's IOC or FIFA. What's happened? What changed?
I mean, I'm not necessarily the best person to comment on that, because, you know, I was always very involved in the touchy-feely end of Olympic bidding. But I do think genuinely that 2004-05, when London was bidding alongside Paris, New York, Moscow, and Madrid, that was really the last time that there was the appetite for cities to want to host an event the scale of the Olympic Games. And really, it is just such an enormous event, which has such a profound impact on a city's infrastructure. And also, you know, with increasing concerns around around security, around, well, I mean, let's look at the situation we're in right now, you know, kind of mega viruses that that seem to spread across the world in moments. That this concentration of enormous numbers of people brings with it layers of complexity that I think do make citizens of countries very concerned about the viability of hosting those sorts of events. And there have been a lot of referenda in the context of Olympic Games, and typically the people have voted against them. I think taxpayers assume that their tax dollar could be spent in better ways, and governments and the private sector partnerships that are established to deliver these games are pretty gun-shy, probably in most cases justifiably, of wanting to take on something of the scale of an Olympic Games or World Cup. Olympic Games more so, because it's concentrated in a single city. But, you know, there are many, many more clever people than I who would be able to articulate the reasons and the shift in the dynamic.
Maybe so, Caroline, but I'm not sure there's many people who could claim to have maybe turned around a bidding process at the last moment. And of course, you know, I'm referring to the Olympics in London. Tell us a little bit about Seb Coe, that winning video, what the thinking was to put together what I think still remains the zenith of what they would call these days shoulder content, but what really is what Giles was saying earlier, that kind of emotional sport content that just always, always wins. Tell us a little the background to what was going on in those crucial days.
Well, what I, you know, I must confess, well, I it's not a confession, it's a fact that London was our very first Olympic bid as a business, and also my first Olympic bid, and we had absolutely no idea what we were doing. And really, when we came on board after the appointment that David Magliano appointed us to work with the bid on creating the narrative for the final presentation, we collectively really just took on the job from a very, very tactical point of view. So as romantic as those films seem, really, the London bid films were made by spreadsheet. We knew that there were 110 members that needed to be persuaded.
Caroline. I'm a romantic. Don't do this to me.
I'm so sorry. There's a huge dose of romance in the end, and that's where I think the creative genius of people like Daryl Goodrich, who directed those films and many of the other bid films, that's where they come in, and you know, they weave their magic. But really, every single decision, you know, the selection of sports that were featured, the selection of languages that were used in the film, the selection of narrator, the way in which the lines were written, absolutely everything was mapped against the votes that that the IR team had identified as being available to London. It was a very, very, very tactical exercise, and we repeated that, and it became more strategic with each bid. And we started earlier and earlier in the bid process. And when we worked with Pyeongchang and most recently with Istanbul, we were involved in their bids from the very, very early stages. And that strategic approach and immersion in the IR process and immersion in the political and public sector, public and private sector objectives, was absolutely critical to evolving the narrative. But to retain your romantic spirit, none of that strategic and tactical work could possibly have been delivered without the magic of the filmmakers who brought those stories to life.
And Caroline, do you think that London, I mean, it was a great games, and you know, we're all British here. Do you think it was a game changer in terms of it being so big and so successful? It actually changed even how bidding was done for future games. If you look at obviously Paris and the games coming to America at long last, it almost feels that the bar was set so high that almost no point smaller cities bidding, because now this is the Olympic Games at the very highest level. Tokyo, I would imagine, is going to be as colossal as any other games. Do you think it's changed everything, London?
My inclination is to say absolutely yes. If I do step back for a minute and try and stop being terribly British and look at it in a more dispassionate way, I think London was the right games at that time. And probably after Sydney in 2000, there had been a sort of more relaxed, isn't necessarily the right term, but I think the bar had shifted, not necessarily been lowered, but perhaps it had pivoted slightly. And I personally think London was the greatest Olympic Games that ever was, not that I'm biased or anything.
Yeah.
But I think London really did set a bar, both from the point of view of the bidding process and the delivery of the games. And that, I can't help thinking, ultimately had quite a profound effect on the way in which that desire to bid has unfolded. But London was an amazing Games. It was just the most extraordinary experience for everybody, I think.
Definitely. Caroline, so let's move forward to another one of the successful bids that you delivered with, along with obviously other people, Qatar. Now, we've not had that World Cup yet, but from the time that you were involved in the bid and delivered that message and ultimately the winning envelope, how do you think it's shaping up a couple of years out now? Is it what you thought the vision would be, or has geopolitics and the reality of hard facts in some way taken a different mood music to the whole event?
Gosh, Roger, I knew I was going to get an interrogation. I hadn't quite expected this.
That's a softball, come on.
We tossed a coin for that question. And Scotland have been Scotland have been on a losing trail since the weekend, so he loses again. Tails, I am, Roger.
Oh, no. Look, the Qatar bid was an unbelievable bid to work on. And we worked with that bid team for 19 months. So worked with them for a very long time. And during that period, really observed a maturing, I would say, of an understanding of the whole landscape of international sport. It really was the most culturally fascinating bid. And I think the result was surprising. I have to say, in spite of working on that bid, that was a tough, tough, tough call to make. And the geopolitical environment and the way in which the world has evolved in the intervening years probably has proven that that was, you know, all of those reservations were probably founded. On the other hand, I genuinely believe that these sorts of things come full circle. And what was unbelievable about working with Qatar on that bid was the optimism and the spirit of belief, particularly in the early stages. And when the very young Sheikh Mohammed, I think he was 22 or 23 at the time, he was leading the bid and really led it with such optimism and such a sense of positivity. That was absolutely infectious. And I really believe sport transcends all of the negativity, all of the difficulty, the challenges that get lobbed at it throughout its evolution. I wouldn't be at all surprised if actually the World Cup in Qatar is a resounding success and proves to be something that does shift perceptions of the country and perceptions of the sport. But we won't know that until 2022, and there's an awful lot of water that can flow under the bridge between now and then. And it is challenged. It's difficult. It's not an easy one.
I think that's right, Caroline. And we should look at it with that optimism. And, you know, nobody ever has a decent word to say about Blatter, and certainly not me. But to be fair to him, you know, I think the idea of taking the World Cup to new territories from South Africa to Japan and Korea before that, and now to the Middle East, fair enough. You know, I think what you're saying there, with all the difficulties, with all the nose holding that we have to do, I think it's probably the right decision. But what I wanted to ask you was something you said a little bit earlier, which, you know, you said that you've left what you were doing before to move into a different type of content, a different type of manageable, snackable content. And in many ways, this podcast is a throwback to that long form way of content that we think there's a certain audience for. I was involved in one of those early stage sports media companies called Give Me Sport that was the very other end of clickbait and that whole kind of like get your quick fixing out. Tell us really honestly what you think needs to happen to the world of content to find the right balance or the right segmentation. Because even in our own little humble operation that we're involved in now, this podcast, Grant, the captain, and myself are always talking about what works as opposed to what we like. And often they're not the same thing, Caroline. So you must live that all the time now. Content that you think will commercially work as opposed to what you think is worthy and great. Tell me a little bit about how you balance those contradictions.
Well, I think, and I know that you've been quite vocal on this as well, I think there's just too much content. And I'm not sure it's that straightforward anymore, given that we do live in our echo chambers of social media. I don't think it's that straightforward to understand what an audience wants. You know, I ran a business that was primarily oriented towards narrowcast communication. We were talking to 110 IOC members or however many FIFA Exco members or whatever. And occasionally we made product that was broadcast on television and via theatrical release. But really, you know, it goes back to that very unromantic notion of the spreadsheet, which I suppose is a pre-tech explosion way of dealing with focusing content on individuals. And I think we are now living in an environment where technology is allowing that very, very personalized experience to become true. So I genuinely, well, I wouldn't be running my new venture, Egoli, if I didn't think that was the future. I really do think that there is going to be a huge shift towards people absolutely on demand being able to watch content in the way they want to watch it, whether that's live or delayed. That's not to say, by the way, that that in any way undermines some of the very high value, high quality content that is produced. And you look at what's happening with Netflix and how comfortable everybody is, you know, paying their subscription every month, same with Hulu, Amazon, who are now becoming big producers. There's phenomenal content being made. But I think the gap between the very high-end, high-cost, high-value content and that snackable, everyday proliferation of stuff that gets made is getting bigger and bigger. Actually, I heard a stat not so long ago that apparently we now produce we produce the equivalent amount of content in 3 days as we produced in the preceding 200 years of celluloid film, which is just staggering. A lot of that content is, by implication, completely irrelevant to most of us. So that divide between the high value, low volume stuff and content that works for the, you know, works on the, in the mass market is definitely getting bigger.
And Caroline, does that therefore make it a really difficult job now for both producers and directors? To, in the old days, it was very much a kind of, I'm going to, you know, broadcasters would say, this is what it's going to be. The editorial decision is made and a direction is made. Now it seems to me that with the choice being the public's and the public can vote with their click and their mouse and whatever else they're watching, is that to try and find content, whether it be short form or long form, that attracts all of the different people must make it almost an impossible job.
Well, I think the broadcaster's job on every level has got harder. And I would not want to be a commissioning editor because really you are, you know, those are the people now who are really battling with needing to make content that can still be sold in the traditional way against, or made, funded in the traditional way against advertising revenue. And as we all know, you know, ad revenue is being spent incredibly differently, what we would have known as ad revenue. So I think it's a very, very hard job. I think where Netflix has sort of risen above or risen to the top, if you like, is entrusting truly creative people to own the content that they make and give them an awful lot of freedom to deliver very high quality authored pieces. And that kind of creative integrity and the confidence of someone like Netflix allowing directors and producers to do that, I think will continue to fuel the very high end of the market and will continue to give us fantastic series.
And so will producers and directors now be taking a lot of their information based on data sources and then trying to create shows around the data, or will there be that artistic integrity that says, I believe in my vision, we're going to go left and almost screw the public, don't ask the public, which way round does it go, who leads who? That's kind of my clumsy question.
I think it's not a clumsy question. My answer was very clumsy. And I think the answer is that the divide between the people who respond to data and the people who define their work by their creative integrity will get bigger. And I do think that there is that the role of the producer in the sort of everyday content or the sort of content that we're seeing in the digital environment, the role of the producer will become much more aligned with being able to understand data and extract information from data and be able to produce content that talks to a particular audience. Whereas at the other end, I think the auteur will once again find their place. And actually, interestingly, after the Oscars last night, delighted to see that a film like Parasite, which is genius and bonkers and brilliant, that a film like that is recognized. Whereas I don't think that long ago it would have been sidelined because it was too auteur-led. So I think that sort of product, it might see a resurgence, but I think that will remain the minority. And then we've got the other end of the market, which is fueling this voracious appetite for content all the time, but relevant content to our particular personal tastes that will be driven by data.
Caroline, you touched on something there that is is very, very key for us, because, and for the whole industry, actually, let's be honest, you know, I know a lot of guys, sports journalists who are in desks or were ex-sports desks, and they will tell you the content that works is the kind of like banter, you know, what about this, what about that, really easy kind of banal type, you know, wind the other guy up or the other girl up type content. And they're trying to fill that gap, even though it's not really what they got into the business for. So following up a little bit on Giles's question, which I think is the key one, is how much are we going to get dragged as sports content to following the big numbers and the big market? And how much will we instead always try and do things like 30-30 and these beautiful films that you were doing, and try and raise the conversation above where its natural equilibrium is?
I think both will continue to exist, but I it does feel like there is so much more appetite for the we used the term before, the sort of snackable content. I think it's interesting to look at what NBC are doing with the Olympics and observing their relationships. Well, first of all, which started, I think, back in Rio with BuzzFeed and the partnership that they formed with Snap. Yeah. I think that is a very, very interesting thing to see. And I'm sure that more and more of that will happen, where actually the very traditional, very defined broadcast commissioning process, or even the live event coverage process, will be loaned, for want of a better expression, to specialists in the area that create the content that works for 5 minutes and then is gone. So I think there is a relationship between the two, but I do think it's quite a tenuous one, and there will be a far greater influence, I believe, that comes from the digital first businesses that ultimately will inform how we consume and enjoy sports content in particular.
And Caroline, do you therefore see that that some of the sports, and I don't mean to pick on the Olympics, but clearly it's the big sport with many 28 summer sports or whatever it may be, and we saw it with winter sports, they allowed in new formats with snowboarding and so on. Do you think over the next 50 years that because of how people are consuming, how television, if that's the right word, is produced, do you think, without putting you on the spot, do you think that there are a number of sports at the Olympic Games that will eventually be decommissioned, as it were, because they simply do not work on the screen? Given that most of the Olympic sports were sort of started pre-television anyway. They were kind of pre-TV, 1850s, the start of de Coubertin's big revolution when he went to the public schools. Don't get me started, but I'll be a historian. But do you think that actually the revolution is coming, is where you'll see a whole lot of new sports or really reformatted sports coming to the Olympic Games in order to attract people to watch through whatever screen they're watching?
I think they're going to have to be changes. Again, stepping quite a long way outside my area of expertise, but there's a huge amount of sport that really doesn't attract the audiences that that you would expect it to attract them to attract. I think the Tokyo 5 is a very interesting experiment, introducing skateboarding, surfing, karate, softball, baseball, and I forget, and sport climbing onto the program for Tokyo, I think is quite a bold move. I think the challenge is that those sorts of sports are required to fund themselves to demonstrate themselves at the Olympics, if you like. And that's very, very tough for emerging sports to sustain their growth and to create an entirely new model for competition in order to become viable as Olympic participants. And, you know, the Olympic model is rigorous. You can't just put up your hand and say, hey, I've invented a new sport. I'd quite like to be on the Olympic program. And it also, for every sport that is, you know, challenging for the crown to come onto the program, it probably means another one's got to go. So it becomes both a political and a practical dogfight. Sounds very aggressive, but I think that's essentially what it is. and takes time.
And do you think the IOC then were ambulance chasing esports a bit? Had they thought that one through? Where clearly there are some massive rights values going on in esports now because they are sort of proven to be tracking and delivering a new audience. And yet esports, for many people, feel anathema to the Olympic Games. Do you think that the IOC were too quick to come in on esports, or do you think they had to kind of cauterize a wound that was already flowing?
Well, I think they're investigating esports. I think rather than making, you know, any sort of huge public alignment and embracing to the point of offering esports a place on the program, it is practical and probably sensible to be tightly aligned with what is going on in the esports environment, because it's certainly a reflection of youth engagement, of the kind of entertainment dynamic that young people expect and demand. I find the term esports extraordinary, although apparently there are all sorts of scientific reasons why it is considered, or why esports are considered a sport, and it's got something to do with the number of reactions every second or something.
Well, I remember, it's funny you should say that, I remember sending a tweet out ages ago about esports, and I got vilified by the esports community for using a hyphen when there isn't one. And I got trolled for the first time in my life about a fucking hyphen. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, sorry, I digress.
Yeah, I can't comment on hyphens. Yes, I don't know. Is there a hyphen? No, obviously not. I think it's sensible for the Olympic movement and ASWAF to be tracking what is going on, because the Olympic Games must remain relevant. If it is to survive, it has to remain relevant. And, you know, the three of us, and I apologize for this, we're past it. We're not the people that are going to be consuming the Olympics in 50 years. The people who are consuming the Olympics at that time haven't been born yet. And it's impossible for us at this point to predict what will happen in terms of technology or media consumption or any of that. I mean, you know, the Olympic Games could be holographic, who knows? And the speed at which technology moves and the speed at which everything changes, I think it's just impossible to predict what might happen.
Well, no, in a sense, what you said about the London Games, I think is interesting. I know it was at the time the most, digital games of all times, and clearly it won't be now because things have moved on and we're in a digital age. But what was interesting is that felt like the games that sat squarely in the old guard of the old-fashioned experiential, the old-fashioned fan, the old-fashioned be there. It just felt like the old times, and now perhaps we're not, and everything is in very much fast forward.
I think you're absolutely right. And I do think London, by dint of history, was the games at that tipping point. I think you're absolutely right. It seems odd now, as we go into Tokyo, to think of London as the most digital games ever. But at the time, well, it was. Certainly not anymore. I think Tokyo will be extraordinary from that point of view.
And you'll be there, presumably. I mean, I think it's going to be an extraordinary... I mean, I was lucky enough to go to the Rugby World Cup in Japan, and they were the most astonishing hosts and put on a brilliant tournament. But the Olympics is many hundred times bigger than a Rugby World Cup. I mean, presumably there is a lot of excitement in your industry.
Well, I'm a bit out of the Olympic industry now. but I think there is... Yes, I think there is excitement. I think... Japan do approach things in a very unique way, and the very, very embedded relationship of technology in the way of life in Japan is very exciting, and to see how that's manifest through an Olympic Games will be fascinating. I think, and you're absolutely right, the Japanese are phenomenal hosts, so I think it will be an amazing Games. Absolutely brilliant. Not London, but...
Caroline, let me come back a little bit to the other passions of my life, because before sport, I was involved in the music business and that whole area there. You talked about, you know, the Oscars. You yourself are a judge for BAFTA, is that correct?
I'm a voting member, yeah. I don't know whether that means I'm a judge, but I get to vote, yes.
So you were saying about the film that won last night, which I saw a couple of months ago. I would push back on that and say that, okay, is that perhaps a kind of like guilty admission that their industry is really dominated now by Disney blockbusters under their various sub-brands, and it's them trying to still pretend that they've got a broad church? Because I kind of sense that's where the film industry is now.
I'm not sure about that. I think certainly commercially, it now seems to be suicide to go to market with a film that isn't a sequel or somehow associated with some other enormous franchise. But creatively, I still think there is, and there continues to be, a real seam of quality creative product. I mean, when you do look at the BAFTA and Oscar and Golden Globes nominees, films like 1917, I mean, my personal favourite this year was Jojo Rabbit. Yeah. I thought it was just an exquisite film. But those films don't get the same marketing budgets because there's just no, you know, the audience is not as dense or as broad. So the commercial opportunities and the opportunities for creating Mattel toys and all sorts of other merchandise and licensed product is minimal. But I do think there's some incredible, incredible creative product around. And I mean, I was surprised that Parasite won the Oscar last night. But in terms of what is out there, it's so wonderful to watch a film that actually addresses a universal theme, but from a very, very oblique perspective. And having worked with the Koreans on the Pyeongchang bid, I absolutely appreciated that film as a reflection of the Korean view of Western society. It was fascinating, really interesting, really beautifully made, and should be celebrated for its competence and its creative value. But commercially, very, very tough to make those films work to the level that the big blockbusters do.
And that's, of course, where the rubber hits the road, also in sport and also in the music business. I want to ask
absolutely.
I want to ask you a little bit how you think that is going to play out in sport in the weekend, where we see talk finally of one of the biggest rights holders, in this case the Premiership, thinking of going to a direct-to-consumer model, which I think is the beginning of the unbundling, the disintermediation, where you see transparency around Chelsea and Arsenal that can do the numbers, but Bournemouth and Norwich don't. The big theme of polarisation in the whole of the creative industries. I am not particularly optimistic. I saw what happened in the music industry, and I think we're at the very lower slopes of dramatic disruption.
I would agree that we're probably just about at base camp. I think it's just starting. I'm sort of holding my breath a little bit on making any sort of prediction, because I do think the direct-to-consumer model might be extremely effective for sports. And whereas on the face of it, the rights model that we're all familiar with, where a broadcaster pays an awful lot of money and the spoils are distributed across the Premier League clubs in this particular case, whilst we're all familiar with that, that is slowing. And there has to be an alternative. Eventually that slowing will become decline. So how does one address that shift in understanding of rights value? And I can't help thinking that to get to a direct-to-consumer model, as long as the consumer related to the particular club or a consumer with a particular interest is properly served, I think that model could work. I don't think it's going to work instantly. And I think there'll be an adoption from a younger audience that then perhaps retrospectively gets fed into the older audience, which might not be all that comfortable. But there must be alternative ways of a rights model evolving from what we've known for the past, 25 years, I guess.
Yeah.
And yet, it's interesting, all of that I agree with, and I do think Basecamp is the way to look at it, and we're seeing it whether the Premier League go down this model or not. It's certainly being talked a lot in the media. And yet the sort of romance of sport, I am a, I'm old fashioned. I'm an advocate of Simon Barnes, the former great Times sports writer, about the importance of sport, not just being about the big, you know, it's not Goliath versus Goliath. There's David versus Goliath as well, which makes sport and makes the narrative. And I do worry, I look at a club like Manchester City, which has bought its way into greatness, but I don't see a lot of, the Manchester City fan would disagree with me, but I don't see much emotion from the mass there. I think Leeds United represent for me a real fandom. And I worry that I'm just chucking it out there. I just worry that this change of media landscape is going to have an untold effect on the actual interest in sport.
Or it may have a positive effect on the interest in sport. I think, you know, if you look at how we now consume information, news information even, based on who we're friends with on Facebook, or what Instagram community we're in, or, you know, who we're connected with in LinkedIn, that forms our opinions in our little bubbles of what we choose to believe. So perhaps if that same principle is applied to sport, where the tribalism is fed, one creates even greater interest, because it's a more personal, more direct experience of a club or a group of players, or a history of a club or a player, or an experience on a Saturday afternoon. And I think I feel pretty optimistic that that could signal something very positive for sport. I mean, we've looked at the migration of free-to-air, which remains the sort of nirvana for every sport. They want to have the sport on terrestrial television without anyone having to pay. We've moved from that into subscription models, and now is the next move into something that's utterly personalized and completely consumer-led. Maybe it's a natural evolution, and maybe it's a good thing.
I think you're right, Caroline. I do agree with you on that. I want to shift gears slightly here now and take advantage of you being on with us to talk about diversity, integration, inclusion, all of those words which, with your BAFTA hat on, you see many, many times on the stage, even last night with acceptance speeches. Surely that can go too far when you've got government ministers then saying that sports talk, football talk in the office shouldn't be allowed because it could be excluding female members of the workforce. How do you feel about all that, Caroline?
Well, as a woman who's enthusiastic about football, I find that slightly offensive. Yeah. I quite like to have a conversation about football. I think it depends whether football's being used as an analogy for aggressive blokish behavior, which, by the way, is not necessarily the appropriate analogy. But clearly one doesn't want workplaces where people are unpleasant to one another. And if that was the subtext of the point, maybe there is one. But I, you know, it just seems to me ridiculous to think that one can in any way limit the subjects people choose to talk about in the office. I mean, by the same token, you know, women might choose, or more women than men might choose, to talk about going shopping on a Saturday afternoon or getting their nails done. Are you going to ban that kind of conversation also because it's offensive to the football loving? And by the way, I'm as interested in fashion and interior design and art as I am in football and rugby and cricket. So I like that diversity, to use your word, of conversation. And I think it's valuable to us to be able to choose whether we participate in conversations or not. So I don't understand where the remark came from. It just didn't make any sense to me at all.
But it seemed to get rebutted. The rebuttal seemed to come back fairly foursquare from all sorts of people, men and women, just saying, what a load of bollocks.
Yes.
Which is, I was quite relieved about, I have to say, because, or if that's maybe not the right word, but it did feel that it was, oh, for goodness sake, can we get over ourselves here?
I think you're absolutely right, Giles. I think the pendulum has swung so far that please God, it's at a point where it's about to start coming back.
Well said.
Because we've moved from a place of an aspiration of equality to one of exclusivity, and that's not healthy for anybody. Let's stay squarely in that space of equality and invest in that. I don't want to get on my soapbox about it, but I do think there are some crazy examples.
Are you very excited? Sorry to interrupt. Are you very excited then that in terms of there's been a huge shift in women's sports and inclusion in the last 10, 15 years? And if the pendulum has swung, and as it often has to do, has to overswing in order to correct itself, do you feel as someone who's been a watcher of the sports industry as well as a big participant of it, that we have moved a long way and that the right steps have been made and more girls are playing sport in school, in society generally, or is there more to do?
I think there's more to do, but I do think there's been an enormous amount of development in women's sports. I mean, I sit on the board of the 100 and, you know, from day one, albeit after, you know, several conversations about the commercial viability of launching the women's 100 at the same time as the men's, the board were really, really committed to making sure that men and women had their opportunity to participate in the new form of cricket from day one. You know, I advised skateboarding for 18 months. We were absolutely adamant that when we were putting together the World Tour and World Championship events, that men and women had the same prize money. The same thing happened in surfing. Those sorts of things, I think, are really, really important in encouraging girls to continue to participate in sport. And there is a huge drop-off in participation still in sport amongst girls, and it tends to happen very young. So if we can continue to send signs that actually women have, or girls and women have, exactly the same opportunities as their male counterparts, it's only going to get better.
Well, it's interesting. I saw in the Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago, Sir Michael Moritz, who's one of the main funders of, or been very involved in Sequoia, has funded Pro Triathlon Organization, which is absolutely celebrating equal prize money in triathlon and creating a pro tour.
Absolutely.
With a made-for-broadcast model. It seems to me that that is the future for sport, which is everything on equality, but also creating for the audience from the get-go.
I think that's absolutely right. It's got to come from the ground up. Retrofitting women's sport onto any kind of sports landscape is much harder and doesn't have as much integrity. So, you know, Sequoia doing the right thing, in my opinion.
Caroline, we really could go on for another hour or two here, but we need to bring it to a close. I can't let you go without picking up on what you said about the 100. I was at an event at the Reform Club this week where David Gower was speaking, and at the Reform Club, you can imagine the audience, really, and you can imagine, and there was a lot of questions about, goodness me, David, Lord Gower, goodness me, what about these newfangled ideas? Tell us, give us your best pitch for the 100 at the same time as you're dealing with the criticism you're getting for KP Snacks as a sponsor.
We had to wrap this up,
yeah,
Roger.
That's really tough. That's like a bouncer. Two bouncers. Two bouncers
to the tail ender.
Wow.
Come on, I've been very good so far. So come on.
Yeah, you have. So I have become a fervent supporter of the 100, and I confess that when I first was invited to join the board, I brought a large dose of cynicism with me. I thought, well, if something's not broken, why fix it? But actually, this is not about fixing. This is about growing the game, using entertainment as a methodology. There are 8.5 million people in this country who have at some point thought that cricket looked quite interesting, but for whatever reason, have never crossed the bridge to actually experiencing cricket. But they are people who are wedded to entertainment formats of all descriptions. And that's what the 100 is for. The 100 is for those 8.5 million people who are interested in music and fun and entertainment and could then quite possibly, in fact, probably, be drawn into the more traditional sports or forms of the sport after they've become enthusiastic about the entertainment format. And I think there's, having worked in sort of urban sports and youth sports for the last couple of years, I think there's so much to be said for that. Make something easy, accessible, music and entertainment led, make it really fun, really exciting, really quick. And then once you've got the audience in the palm of your hand, you have them there, able to draw them into whichever aspect you want to take them. And I think that is what the 100 is going to do. And I genuinely believe it'll do it very successfully. And the KP snacks thing, I mean, you know, I think one has to be absolutely realistic. And Giles, I'm going to refer to your Captain's Table podcast here, where you talk to your guests about the food that they choose to eat at sports events. Going to an entertainment event is something that is fun and out of the ordinary. I don't think we can be advocating that people never have a peanut or a crisp. Everything in moderation is absolutely fine. And this should be, this is snack cricket. It's a short form of cricket where people go and have a good time, let their hair down. It's about families and about breaking the mold and doing something fun together. And if that can't include some snacks like crisps and peanuts, then I'm not sure what should.
Well, you're completely right.
Although I'm not advocating that becomes a staple diet.
You're absolutely right. So it was absolute another storm in a teacup whipped up by people who really need to get out more, and just did my head in, I have to say.
And the bouncer was hooked for four, dispatched without any mercy. Wonderful answer, Caroline. Wonderful. And listen, thank you so much. Honestly, I feel as if we've just started. It's such a smooth journey, this. And as Grant said the other day, we need to do it again. Well, maybe you just want to do it with him. I don't know. But I've really enjoyed this, Caroline, and I want to thank you so, so much.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure. I'm so delighted to have been able to be on the show. Thank you so much for inviting me. Really good fun for a Monday afternoon, Thursday. When does this go out? Anyway, really good fun.
Thank you, Caroline.
Thanks a lot.
Brilliant. Take care. See you.
Bye.
Bye.
There we are.
Well, I'll tell you what, she took your fast-paced bowling and absolutely smacked you all over the ground. It's
yeah, well,
joy.
Listen, those are some of the best answers I've heard from some prickly questions. And again, it gives me reason to believe that, and I'm not just saying this because it kind of rebalances my misogynist personality, I think there should be a lot more women in sport, because, you know, so many bad decisions are made because they're testosterone led, they're people leading with their chin or their chest. And, you know, look, those answers were perfect, and they're fruit of a superior thought process that takes all the emotion out of it. I was really impressed, Giles.
Well, I take a slightly different view. I just think sport, like everything else, should be meritocratic, and the best people should be doing the best jobs and leading it. And Caroline is proven in the industry over a long, long time. And as you say, everything she says, it just smacks of good sense.
Yep. Well, we forgot to ask her how to find her on social media and everything like that, but we'll do that on the Twitter account. So I think that's us, Captain. I think we're done.
Yeah, I'm exhausted. That was good. We'll have to do this again quite soon, I think.
Absolutely. So the usual closing comments around voting for us, ranking us, recommending us to all your friends. And as I say at the top of the show, the kind of guests that we're seeing on this podcast now from Giles at the Captain's Table are astonishing. So it's well worth letting your friends know. And you can find us on Twitter at entertainedr, as in the words. And you can find Giles at
@GilesMorgan71.
And myself, as always, I'm at @RPMComo, as in the lake.
As in the lake.
Thank you, everyone, and have a great week. Take care.